My name is Lissa DeFreitas, and I will be your host as we journey together in a four-part series about conversations on living and dying well. This is brought forth in partnership with BGH Community Hospice and Kootenai Health. May I offer a very special acknowledgement of gratitude to KRFY Panhandle Community Radio for supporting our conversation series and making it possible to bring these conversations to each of you. Our four-part series will allow us to journey together through the continuum of living that absolutely includes dying. Today, we have the gift of being in conversation with a panel of leading-edge experts in the field of palliative care. We welcome our community partners that can speak to their living life in the presence of chronic and stage 4 illness. So often in life, we find ourselves in a new and unexpected situation, perhaps a diagnosis of a life-limiting illness. In Dr. Gwandi's recent book, Being Mortal, he highlights the importance of having hope and a plan. As well, the transformative gift that stepping into conversation can have on the quality of our life. Today, and with our four-part series, we have a unique opportunity to be in conversation, to listen, explore, and perhaps expand our own thoughts about living and dying. As we introduce this first series, A Matter of Life and Death, please assist me in welcoming Dr. Nicole Pelly of Kootenai Health, Tammy Fahan, BGH Community Hospice and Home Health Manager, Father Nolan Redman, Vita Redman, and Jenna Moss, LCSW in private practice here in Sandpoint and an integral part of our community hospice team. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
So, Dr. Pelly, I just wanted to start with you this morning because just recently I had the opportunity to listen to your palliative care talk at the Geezer Forum that we have here locally. And one of the things you mentioned, you were looking at the whole continuum of living. And in that, you explored how conversations really assisted families in preparing for the end of life as well. So in your words, how would you describe palliative care? What is that? And I'm wondering if you could speak to that today.
Palliative care is a new word, a new set of words that we're beginning to hear about more and more, much part to Dr. Gawande's book, Beyond Mortal. It's a type of medicine that looks at patients who have serious and chronic illnesses, who want a safe place to talk about the end of their life, how to plan it, but also how to treat and deal with symptoms of chronic illness. In palliative care, we sometimes treat symptoms like nausea, shortness of breath, or pain. But we also are a place where people can come to say the things that they're maybe afraid to talk about at home around the dinner table. Death and dying is something that as a culture we don't often talk about. We know it's there, but we don't bring it into our lives every day. And I really think that with palliative care, we're a place where we can make dying a little bit more normal. And I think that's really important right now.
Oh, that's beautiful. Thank you for sharing that. You know, earlier, just before we stepped into the studio, there was a question about what is the palliative care physician? How does that physician, the work that you do, tie in with the whole spectrum of care?
As a palliative care physician, I work in partnership with the rest of the patient's care team. So with their primary care physician, with their cardiologist, with their oncologist. Mm-hmm. I call myself the moss between the cracks sometimes because there are things that fall through the cracks for all of us. And I like to be the one to find those little places that we can just make a little bit better. We can address suffering in different ways. Sometimes suffering is spiritual, sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it's physical. But because our body encompasses all of those things together. Palliative care is a place where we can peel some of those layers away to find out where that suffering is. Mm-hmm. In palliative care, I put focus on the patient as a whole person, and the story of that person is a part of their illness journey. But really, we start with a story of who the person is as a person, and the illness comes into it later. So when I first meet a patient, I begin with, who are you as a person? Where did you grow up? Who were your children? What brings hope and meaning to your life? And only later do we get into the illness part of thing and talking about that. Mm-hmm. In palliative care, it's equally important to me to talk about the unacceptable things to a patient. We take many things on, say, the cancer journey as an expected part of the journey, whether it's chemotherapy or radiation. But we often don't think about, where are my limits? What do I not want to have happen? So in palliative care, my goal is to keep the patient in control at all times, mm-hmm. that we allow the person, the individual, to walk the journey of their life in the way that they want to. I try to amplify the patient's story. So often when we're having things thrown at us, whether it's labs or treatments, we feel like we, as people, get lost in all of that. My job is to calm that situation down and bring the person to the surface again. And I ask the questions, are we doing what you really want us to do? Sometimes that discussion involves deciding when to stop doing treatment. A lot of patients are afraid to stop doing treatment. They don't like the side effects, but they don't necessarily want to stop. In palliative care, we talk about where their limits are, what's unacceptable, where does quality of life fit into this? Are they having quality of life right now? If not, what can we do to improve that quality of life? And sometimes it's as simple as reminding people and defining what does bring them hope every day, and how can we increase that hope in the midst of their treatments. Often my patients tell me that it's the beauty of nature in North Idaho that gives them hope, and that that's the thing that gets them out of bed every morning, takes them to the window, and makes them want to live another day, even in the face of chronic suffering. I try to find ways to get people literally out in the woods sometimes, because sometimes the palliative care treatment is focus on what brings you hope and joy and do more of it. Mm-hmm. Because the journey to dying is actually more about living than it is about dying. I like to think of it as if we had a whole plate full of chocolate chip cookies. They'd look delicious, but there'd be a lot of them. But if we only had one chocolate chip cookie, how special would that chocolate chip cookie be? How can we adapt that attitude to every day that we live? We know we all have a limited number of days. We don't know how many they're going to be, but how do we make every single day have the same degree of depth and meaning and importance and strength as if it were our last, as if it was that last chocolate chip cookie? That's what I want to encourage my patients to live like every day.
Wow. That's so beautiful, Dr. Pelley. Thanks for sharing that. And just thinking about the whole spectrum of palliative care and when hospice comes in and how does that happen in terms of the work you do in preparing people. And Tammy, I'm wondering if you could speak to a little bit about how you team together with a palliative care physician and what does that look like for someone when they're ready for hospice?
Thank you. And boy, it's hard to follow what you just said. It's just such a beautiful journey. Dying, living and dying is a beautiful journey. Hospice is a beautiful journey. And we do partner with people when a cure for their illness is not likely. It does not mean that it is inevitable at that moment. It means that they are in a process where a cure is probably not going to happen for that illness or that injury that they have. And we partner very closely with what Dr. Pelley just said about, you know, really looking at that person and what is it that brings them the most joy? What are their goals? What are their desires? What are their wishes for the last amount of time, whatever that looks like? People often confuse hospice with the very end. We hear it's a death sentence. It's the finality. And in reality, it's part of a beautiful journey. And the sooner hospice is able to come in and help to partner with that person and their family, their loved ones, their support system, the greater that journey can be. So we oftentimes come in the last year of someone's life and help to partner with them to manage all of the spectrum of what they need, whether it be physical issues, emotional, spiritual, and just pure joy issues with their family, their loved ones. And our team just circles around them and brings the greatest quality that we can to them.
Thank you, Tammy. That's very beautifully shared. And one of the things that I heard in what you shared was that some people might push away from hospice as a potential because they have certain myths about what that means. I heard you say a death sentence. Are there other myths that you commonly hear? And Jenna, please feel free to step into this part too, because I think you both hear this a lot in terms of the different myths that we hear about hospice.
We often hear that hospice is giving up. And actually, patients and their families feel that way sometimes when a physician presents that as an option. They feel as if maybe their provider has given up on them. In reality, it truly is part of a beautiful journey, and it's giving someone options to really enjoy and explore and have the greatest quality in each of their days. That's a common myth, is giving up. Another common myth.
It's okay. What about giving up hope? A lot of times I hear that from people is that, well, I don't know about hospice because I have to kind of give up hope. How would you speak to that, Jenna?
So hope has many definitions, but so I when I go into a family's home initially, whether to do a hospice informational visit or to actually open them up to join hospice, I cast a net, and I'm trying to feel out what would make this very special time the best that it can be. And so hope is often talked about with just hope for a cure or hope for a life to go on at the way that it was. And that is not possible anymore. But there could be hope for a great day, and there could be hope for intimate conversations or whatever that family unit wishes for that time, or what's most important. Because I think the beauty of being a hospice provider for me is that I get to witness what happens towards the end of life. And it teaches me, how do I want to live my life? Because my next day is not promised. And so it's a beautiful gift in that way. So what do they hope for? What would they love? You know, how can we assist them? We have such an amazing team of medical personnel to help with symptoms, and then social workers to develop resources and help them talk about this important time of life, as well as our amazing volunteers that just do the full gamut, you know. So we can make this time, especially if they come in early, to make it as good as it can be, and actually almost celebratory at times.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. And I want to check in with you, Dr. Pelly, because I'm remembering in your talk at the Geezer Forum, you had questions that were often a catalyst for people to really touch in with themselves to say, what is important to me? What do I think about this life? What do I think about this dying? Would you be open to sharing some of the questions you often share with others?
I think of palliative care as the time before hospice when we can put many things in order. Sometimes people think of that as just their financial matters or their matters that are solid around them in their houses. But really, it's a time to put relationships in order also. Mm-hmm. One of my roles as a palliative care physician before we get to the hospice stage is to find places where things feel like they're maybe not in order and the patients haven't recognized that themselves. Mm-hmm. So I ask questions about their family, about who's important to them, about symptoms that might be interfering with their ability to work or live their life or do things that they want to do on a daily basis. I ask them when they got really, really sick, where would they want to spend their time and what types of things would they not want to have happen? Would they want to be in an ICU? Would they want to have a breathing tube in their throat where they couldn't talk with their family and friends? Would they want to have a feeding tube? I allow them to define their wishes in a safe place that allows them to stay in control then of their wishes. So often working in the ICU setting, I've seen situations where an individual is critically ill and surrounded by family members at the bedside, all of whom are saying, "Mom would never have wanted to end up here. This was not how she wanted to be." I take my role as a palliative care physician to say, what do you not want to have happen? And then how do we make decisions very early in the disease process so that people don't end up in the place that they don't want to be? I think for the baby boomer generation, as the baby boomers age, control of their lives is very, very important to them. They've lived their life in a way where they are in charge and they want things to go the way that they want to go. We don't always have that option right at the end of life, but we try to make it as much of, we talk about birth plans sometimes. I think we need to start talking about dying plans. Who do you want around the bedside? Who's important to you to come in and out? Who do you not want to see? Sometimes those things are more important. Do you want to die with your dogs around you? Do you not want to have your cat in the room? Those kinds of details are actually very, very important, but it's only by asking what do you want and what do you not want and putting it on paper that we can get to that place. Oftentimes I find that as important as it is to put things on paper and make them legitimate so that members of your medical team can access them if you end up in a critical situation, equally and perhaps more important is when members of your family hear your words about what you want and don't want. Oftentimes, something unexpected can happen and you can end up in a situation where you cannot make your wishes known because you're unconscious or you're critically ill. If your family members have listened to that conversation about your wishes, as we partner in that discussion, it's often much easier for them to make those decisions for you than if you just had written them down on a piece of paper and handed it to them. Mm-hmm. So I feel that the conversations about living and dying are very, very important to have well before you get sick. I divide life into three stages when we think about planning things. When we're young, something tragic and unexpected could happen. Who would you want to make your medical decisions in those stages? It's very important to do some kind of advance directives in the form of a power of attorney for healthcare, which would be in effect only if you were unable to make decisions for yourself. So if you're 25 and think dying is a long way away, it may only be as far away as that ATV accident that you could have unexpectedly. Who's going to make your medical decisions for you? If you can just do that one document, that's really, really important. As we age, or if we begin to become more ill, it's important to start thinking about, well, what's unacceptable? What's acceptable? What kinds of things would I want to have happen? Then as we approach the third stage, and we have perhaps a limit to our life based on a disease such as heart failure or cancer or severe lung disease, it's important to start thinking about, how do I actually want to die? Do I want to be resuscitated if something unexpected happened to me? So often when we ask that question, do you want us to try to restart your heart? That sounds wonderful when we ask it that way, but the reality of what a resuscitation involves and the results of an attempted resuscitation are often very different than what people want. And it's those attempted resuscitations that end people up in the ICU with a more limited brain functioning situation, and in that place where they say, this is not how mom or dad would have ever wanted to be. So if you have a critical illness or you feel that you're approaching the end of your life at some point, it's important to fill out the Idaho Post form that addresses the question of resuscitate or do not resuscitate. So really three stages to planning: when you're young, when you're in the middle stage, and then when you're in the end stage. I think that's important to delineate. And in palliative care, I support all kinds of curative and life-prolonging treatments, whether it's chemotherapy or all kinds of interventions. It's a good time to talk about that advanced directive planning when you're in palliative care before you get to that very end of your life. When we no longer have curative or life-prolonging treatments, or the patient decides that the side effects of the treatments that they're going through no longer support the quality of life, that's a time when we begin the discussions about starting hospice. And it's so important I feel, as a culture, that we reevaluate this word hospice. Because as Tammy and Jenna mentioned, we think of hospice as this life sentence and this very short-term kind of care for just the last couple days or couple of weeks of life. But in fact, hospice has benefits paid for by Medicare that extend over a six-month period. Many people live past that six-month period, come out of hospice, and go back into hospice at a later point in time. Most people, when I explain that, don't realize that you can actually survive hospice, yeah, or that you can have multiple times in hospice. So important to think about hospice in a different way, as a long-term kind of care, as you're beginning to approach the end of life. Mm-hmm. When you're looking for a kind of care that doesn't involve frequent visits to the doctor's office, doing procedures that aren't going to make a difference to the overall length of your life or quality of your life, that's the time to think about that transition to hospice and to think about it as a positive aspect and supportive aspect on this journey of living and dying, rather than just those final couple days of life.
That's it's beautifully shared.
Part of that spectrum of care, really, is what hospice is. Yeah. And I just wanted to just piggyback on what you said about those conversations. They are such a gift to have with your family. When you have given your family the gift of having that conversation and the comfort they have knowing exactly what you want, it takes so much pressure off of them.
I love everything that was shared, because what I'm hearing is that's so essential to provide a conversation and maybe ask the questions where people can make choices and recognize that there's a spectrum of choices to be made, and that hospices really could be a longer term process than a short-term process, and that within it, it could flux and change depending what is happening with that person. And through the journey, we're inviting people to really explore themselves and what matters and what's important to them, and that we're having an ongoing conversation. So thank you all for sharing that piece, because I really feel that really gives a very, very full spectrum of palliative care. And one of the things that I had hoped to explore with you, Jenna, and we talked about this earlier, because I know that you work with people on so many different, very, very intimate levels in terms of exploring those questions. But what are some things that you have experienced yourself that, because I heard you say this a little earlier about this is teaching you about the importance of living. What are some things, takeaways for you that have really assisted you in your own life?
Well, number one, and most important, I think, is who is around you at the end of your life. And those relationships have been cultivated throughout your life. And so we go into family systems, and I don't know their history, and so we see the whole gamut, and it's very beautiful when people can put their challenges, that because there's challenges in every relationship, behind them and show up in love and care, because that's the foundation of their relationship as a family and friends. It's very difficult when that can't happen. So that's the one thing, is to take care of our relationships while we're living, for sure. And then also to cultivate an appreciation for the present moment. And that's where we live our life, in the present moment. And if we're too attached to how things will go, we suffer more. So those are my two big takeaways.
That is very beautifully shared, Jenna. Thank you so much for your shared experience. And I'm wondering if this might be a perfect segue to hear from you, Father Nolan. Just thinking about your experience with a stage 4 cancer, and how has that impacted your living life? What are some things that you gleaned from this journey?
Well, I think I want to say the first thing that I've learned is that it is a journey. And it doesn't just begin with the diagnosis of cancer. Actually, mine began with my first wife's diagnosis and being a caregiver for 13 years. And I learned so much in that process. And so one thing that's important to me is to recognize that the person with the diagnosis is not the only one involved. There's a community that surrounds them. And it's important to be aware that we're on a journey, but we're not alone. For example, believe it or not, this right now is part of my support system to be around people who are knowledgeable, like the fellow panel members, who are so willing to share and talk openly about this issue. When I was first diagnosed and I started sharing it with friends, they didn't want to hear what I had to say. And so that led me to seek ways to be able to talk to people. And that's been a very, very important part of my journey, is to have supportive people, knowledgeable people, who understand and are willing to work with me. I remember the first day that I was diagnosed with cancer. I was not expecting this diagnosis. My doctor was not expecting this diagnosis. But my response was very simple. I said, okay, what's next? And actually, that's been every step of my journey. Okay, what's next? I was not frightened by the diagnosis, primarily because my wife had gone through this and I had an awareness of the positive things that can happen. I also have a dear friend who once told me when she was diagnosed with cancer that cancer was a gift. And I thought, wait a minute. And that over the years, I've discovered more and more how true that is. So this journey that I'm on is a gift. And it's not just a gift for me, but it's a gift for the community around me. This is a very positive experience for me. I'm very blessed because I've been in stage four for 8 years now. And I have to be aware, though, through this, that I have a serious issue. I was driving in to get my treatment a couple weeks ago at my oncologist. And I said, Nolan, you have cancer. And so I said, yeah, I do. Well, it was supported when I talked to the medical people, and I brought up the idea that one of my oncologists had said, you have a sleeping dog. Mm. Whoa. And that's part of the reality of being stage four. Mm. We have no idea what comes next, but the blessing is through this journey, I've discovered that what we do is we live each day without fear. And I've learned to accept the condition that I have without fear. I work very hard to not allow myself compromise my immune system by emotions that aren't helpful. And I'm supported in that by my community that's willing to laugh with me and smile. And we can talk about this without it being something that we're not going to deal with. I've been blessed on this journey. And so that's really what I want to say. What helps me live today is that I'm on a journey, but I'm surrounded by a community of family, by a faith community that I serve, by a community like here in this room right now, by a community of medical people that take care of me. And I am so blessed to be part of this. So the answer for me is living is a journey no matter where you are. But I think it does get intensified when you have a diagnosis. But the key to me is not to allow that diagnosis to determine how you live your lives day by day. Live it without fear. Live it filled with hope and expectation. We don't know what the end result will be precisely, except that at one point, all of us will face that moment of death. But in the meantime, there's a lot of great living to experience.
Yes.
Motion, which affects our entire bodies on a deep physiologic level. We can translate all of these emotions into hormones and neurotransmitters, which can have a negative impact on our immune system if we allow ourselves to spend a lot of time in them. By bringing fear to the surface, which is actually something we do a lot in palliative care, one of the questions I ask is, what are you afraid of? And interestingly, probably 99% of my patients take the opportunity to say, you know, I'm actually not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of what comes before. And so by talking about that, what comes before, by laying out a plan, because when we don't have a plan, things are more fearful, but by focusing on hope and coming up with a plan for whatever it may look like, what's next, we always can have a plan for what's next, then we can eliminate that fear is my hope, so that patients feel that they are embraced by a system which will care for them on all levels, whether it's their family and friends around them, whether it's addressing their medical and symptomatic kinds of needs, including enrolling in hospice. So when people have a plan, they are less afraid, and they are then more able to do just what Father Nolan said, which was embrace every single minute of every single day as the gift that it truly is.
Thank you. Vita, I was wondering, did you want to say something?
I just wanted to add one thing. When I said that I was told that I have a sleeping dog, I've taught myself to love my sleeping dog.
Mm-hmm. Powerful. Vita, I would love to hear from you today. One of the things I heard Nolan say was the gift and the blessings that happen with the community that surrounds them. And just wondering how this journey is for you as a care partner. And in addition to that, you had shared with me that you yourself have been living with a chronic illness. And how does that all tie in for you in terms of living life and being on purpose?
First, thank you for the opportunity, I think. For me, Nolan's diagnosis of cancer initially was devastating to me, because I've always seen cancer as, you know, cancer equals death, and it's going to come sooner than not. And so it was, when I saw him later the day that he was diagnosed, he was okay. He was just okay and his happy-go-lucky self. And I thought, good grief, really? This is how you're looking at this? And I started grieving immediately. It was so different. It was not knowing what it meant. What is it like to embody cancer? What is that like? I had no idea. But slowly, and it took some time, slowly I began to see that it was either putting myself in a fetal position and not dealing with it and ignoring it, or just letting it take over my life completely and our lives and my thoughts and everything, or continue to live with him as he lived with cancer. And there was no getting away from cancer. I envisioned getting into the car and just driving away and thinking, okay, I'm just going to drive and get away from it. But I can't do that. And it wasn't until I myself was diagnosed with fibromyalgia And I started thinking, okay, it's not cancer, but it is a chronic disease. And I was so happy to hear today from you, Dr. Nicole, that cancer can be a chronic thing. And I'd never heard that before. So thank you for that. So when I started thinking about the fibromyalgia and how I was going to live with this, I started realizing that I had to see this also as a gift for myself. I began to do all the proper things that I had to physically for myself to start taking better care of my body. And I had never really listened to my body. I had never listened to what it was saying to me, what my joints were saying, my muscles, anything. I had never done that before. And to start listening to it and embodying it, I have fallen in love with fibromyalgia. It's my friend. It's my friend. It has taught me so much about myself, so much about Nolan's cancer. It's still there. We forget. Sometimes we go along and we just forget. And then something happens, like him coming home from his last appointment and saying, you know, there is a sleeping dog here in the house with us. And it's like, oh, geez, do we have to look at that again? But it's okay, because I'm choosing to live my life. I'm choosing to live our life. In our home, we have several sayings that no one has it better than we do. And life for us in our home is like gas prices. We can't control that gas price. We can't. It's gas prices. And, you know, it's living every day to the fullest, to the best, not hoping, completely hoping all the time, knowing that there's a bigger promise than I can even imagine. I can even imagine. It's bigger than I am.
Saying yes to the experience of chronic illness is a really important thing. And when a person receives a diagnosis or has a tragic death happen, community can be at the core of that healing and that beauty in that situation. And as we sit in a community radio station in this wonderful community of our own, I think a lot about the role of community in illness. And when I say saying yes to that, what it means is when you have an unexpected and difficult thing happen, it's amazing the people who respond and the people who don't respond. Sometimes your closest friends don't really know what to say and they drift away. And sometimes people show up who you never would have expected to show up. You have to say yes to the experience, to allow the people who choose not to walk that part of the journey with you, to allow them to be where they're going to be, and then to say yes to the people who are arriving with a new part of beauty on that journey. We don't really know who's going to accompany us on this part of the journey, and I do love that journey vision that you talk about, Father Nolan. I agree with that very, very, very much, because on a journey, the landscape changes every single day. One day we may be in a desert, the next day we may be in a snowstorm. We don't know where we're going to be on that journey each day. We just hope that we have the things we need for that day. And sometimes the things we need arrive in very unexpected packages. So remembering to say yes. So often when people offer to help, especially when we're highly independent North Idahoans, we tend to say, no, 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 I got to cover it. I don't need anything. It's okay. But we need to change our mindset on that and allow the people who offer something to bring it to us. So I encourage people to say, if somebody offers you something, rather than the instinctual, no, that's okay, we don't need anything, just say yes. It's an opportunity into a whole new relationship, possibly, and a whole new part of the journey.
I love what you're sharing about community and how it can shift through the spectrum of care. And Jenna, it reminds me of the kinds of family systems that you often run into and how sometimes there is an expectation that okay, so this person's going to be here, that person's going to be here. But it doesn't always look like that at the end of the day. You know, it could end up being very different. It could be that our volunteers are teaming. It could be that other community partners are coming in and supporting. It could be that you yourself are working with that client to really look at how do we build community? How do you address that aspect of community building in your work?
Exactly. I just a case comes to mind that I'd like to share. And there was a homeless woman that had hospice. And she was pretty shut down, I'd say, initially, and kind of cranky. We found her a placement that didn't work, but she was very clear that it wasn't working. And so we found another one. She went up to extended care in Bonner's Ferry, and they just loved on her. And we got to know her over time, and I thought, oh, this is a woman that had plans and that had a life, and something happened to switch it that she ended up living in her truck. But she was very organized, and we loved her. And as my teacher, Frank Ostaseski, says, you love them until they can love themselves again. And by her being there, she blossomed. So it wasn't her family. She didn't want us to call her family. And our volunteer, who was a very new volunteer, stepped up and would go up to Bonner's Ferry and be with her there. And the weekend that she died, she stayed all weekend with her. And so this transformation, she was called back to life till the moment that she died. And so you're right. It isn't sometimes the people you think it is, but we're interconnected, you know, and our community. So like Dr. Pelley said, you know, say yes, because we need each other.
Yeah.
And it doesn't have to look in a prescribed way. It can be another way. But at the end of the day, it's all about the love that we're sharing.
Absolutely. So beautifully shared, Jenna. And just in looking at this whole beautiful gift of conversation that we're having, I just want to thank each of you, because what you're bringing to this conversation is so essential. Looking at really about living life. And that, Jenna, what you just said is it does not matter. I mean, you could turn on and switch on your life in maybe only hours before your death. But the fact that it happened, what an amazing gift. And that we are here as a community, loving each other and supporting each other. And sometimes in those times of crisis, it is hard to say yes. Because maybe I've never said yes in my whole life, and I've always done it by myself. But to say yes to someone walking with you through the journey is amazing. And so
I ask myself sometimes at the end of a day, if I died tonight in my sleep, would I have changed anything? Have I had the best day, the best last week? How happy am I tonight? Would this be okay to have had this as my last day? Sometimes I ask myself in the middle of my day, if today was my last day, what would I do differently right now? And it causes me to pause and to step outside and to look at the stars and to feel the wind and to call the friend that has been on my mind, but I haven't taken the time to contact, to put down my phone, to take my son's hand, to do lots of other kinds of things. Now, I hope I don't die in my sleep tonight, but I could. But if I do, have I done everything today that I wanted to do? And that is the point of living on our dying journey.
Yes. That is beautifully shared.
And we are all on that dying journey, each one of us, no matter where we are in the spectrum of our lives, we're getting there day by day. I love what you shared. It's so powerful. And what you guys shared about the inspiration that you are to all of us, embracing a chronic illness and just loving it and loving where you are and allowing others to be there with you. And I have to say, having been on the end of helping someone through that journey, it is such an incredible gift to have someone say yes and to be allowed to partner with them and to help them. So those of us who so often do everything on our own, it's a beautiful gift to those around us. And just remember that.
Yeah. Jenna, you
know
had something.
I know that I wouldn't be in the space that I am without having married an Episcopal priest, for one. That's been a huge change in my life because it has brought me to people at their end days, and I've learned to embrace the holy ground that I'm on when they are there, when they're in that time. And it's made it easier for me to embrace my fibromyalgia, to embrace the cancer that we live with, because I know that this isn't the end. And every day I choose to it either being an adventure or not. And I choose to have an adventure, whether it's a good day or a bad day. I have to look for that good adventure in it.
I love the analogy that you said, Vita, about gas prices, that we can't control gas prices. And then it made me think, well, yeah, sometimes people get a diagnosis and those gas prices are high, and so they decide they're going to shut down, they're going to stay home because they don't want to pay those prices. And others, you know, would take a cross-country trip. You know, I'm still going. I'm still going to live my life exactly the way I would have. But then there's like that middle ground that is like, I'm going to acknowledge that those gas prices are high. And I'm going to see what my values are. And where do I need to go to have this life as an adventure and to feel fulfilled while those gas prices are high? And those are the beautiful decisions. And I think why this is a gift, both to be a caregiver, because you get to work with your values on a regular basis, and to have these chronic illnesses and terminal illnesses, that it teaches you what your values are and to put your attention there. So I love that analogy.
We think of the world as being a really large place, and when we're younger and healthier, we tend to travel the world without regard to that being difficult, because it really isn't at that time. And as we either age or we develop illness of some kind, our world can become smaller. Sometimes it goes from 7 continents into a year into just your house and not being able to leave your house. Being able to find beauty, enjoy in the space that is whatever your space is that day, not necessarily traveling the world, but home with a crackling fire, with the people that you love around you. Finding the beauty in that and being able to do that is one of the lessons that you learn on this journey. And it's a lesson that develops out of both illness and aging.
I'd like to just add that I try every day at some point during on the day to say, ho hum, another day in paradise.
One question I often ask my patients is, what do you think happens after you die? It's a wonderful glimpse into a person's thoughts, and it often provides information as to what someone's afraid of. There's a lot of different thoughts about what happens after we die. No one is right, no one is wrong, and the reality of it is most of us don't really know what that journey when we die is going to be like. It's not my place as a palliative care physician to judge. I have patients who are atheists, and I have patients who are extremely religious individuals. But what's fascinating to me on a human level is that the majority of people answer that question by saying, I don't really know, but I have a sense that there's something that kind of continues. There's something about me that's kind of going to continue. I just don't know what it looks like. And I found that fascinating in my role, being able to ask that question to so many different types of people, that there's a common thread to humanity somewhere in that. I don't understand it exactly, but I just know that I see it and I hear it daily from all my patients.
Beautiful.
I was able to witness my mother's dying process over 3 months. And she was very spiritual. She had a strong connection with God. And over time, she would sit, if she lived in Florida, and she would sit in the sunshine all day and talk to God. And she started saying that she was like between both worlds. She was here and she was there. And then she said, Jenna, the world, the veil between the worlds is thinning. I can't really explain it. And then towards the very end, she would say, I'm more there than here. And we see this in people. And families can sometimes be upset about it, that it seems like their loved one, as they're dying, is withdrawing and not present to them and to the life that they had, and they're leaving before they've left. But I really do see this process that of this journey, and it's almost like you're attaching somewhere else and becoming more luminescent. So it's that's beautiful to witness. And it happens on a regular basis, though people can't always explain it in those words.
I'd like to add that we all come to, in our journeys, from a faith perspective that's our own. And I am a firm believer that we each have to make our own choices with that. But I'd like to encourage everybody to be open to the possibilities that lay before us and not be afraid of whatever that is. It's interesting sitting at this table and hear things that I've heard throughout my ministry. When my first wife was dying, she'd fall asleep or not communicate, and she'd wake up, and I'd say, "So what's happening?" And she said, "I've been to that other place." And I said, "What?" And she said, "I've been to that other place." It's that thing that you said about your mother.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know. We don't know what that is, but it's a mystery. And I would like to think that we are going to be delightfully surprised what happens there.
Part of this journey is really embracing the mystery.
Yeah.
In this era of being able to Google everything and knowing everything about everything in 2.3 milliseconds, this is an area of great mystery about which we simply don't know. And I hope that as a society, we can become more okay with not knowing, because I think that helps us embrace that journey.
Yes.
I've spent a lot of time, and my spiritual background is with Native Americans in South Dakota on the Rosebud Reservation. And they have taught me that this journey concept, we have a journey in life, and we have a journey after our death also. And if you read the obituaries in Rapid City, you'll see that Native obituaries often say, rather than this person died on this day, this person began their journey on this day. And it gives a whole different impression of what death can be. Maybe it's just the start of the next journey. In many Native communities, and obviously there are so many different types of Native communities with all different beliefs, but in some Native communities, that journey belief and the ceremonies that surround that journey belief are powerful tools for the survivors to deal with their grief in a way that is very different from our typical white culture.
Yes, that's beautifully shared. And I love the part of the great mystery. In that also is a question that comes up in the healing journey, in the grieving journey, because everything gets changed. And the question is, can we be okay with not knowing who we are going to end up being in that transformational place? And that's something that we're going to have an opportunity to explore even more deeper in our second segment. But we're kind of coming to a closure in this first, so I want to thank each of you for your beautiful gift of sharing and conversation. I am so moved from every bit of this conversation. And I'm thinking, a way to close would possibly be informational in that, how would we connect with a palliative care physician? How do we connect with hospice? What would that be? Would either of you like to share ways people can connect with you?
As a palliative care physician, I see new patients every single day. The way to connect with me is to call our office at Kootenai Health in Coeur d'Alene at 208-625-6960. I do ask for a referral from another physician because palliative care does not work in its own silo. We connect with all of your other care team taking care of you. So I want a referral from another physician simply so that I know a little bit more about your medical background, and that allows me then to connect into your care team. So your care team could put that referral in, or you can call our office and we can give you more information on how to make that happen.
That's beautiful. Thank you for sharing
and
that.
And I should add that I do see patients in Sandpoint as well as Coeur d'Alene and Post Falls. So
that's important to know.
Try to come to you because it's not always easy for people with serious chronic illnesses to travel distances. So yeah. we make ourselves available in your own backyard.
That's important to know. Thank you, Dr. Pelley. And Tammy?
And Bonner Community Hospice is our boundary and Bonner County's only not-for-profit hospice. And it does take a physician's referral to us. However, if you have questions or you're wanting to start thinking about, you've reached that point, or maybe your loved one has reached that point where cure may not be an option for an illness, and you're wondering what's next in that journey and how can you have health professionals partner with you to help you make those decisions, it's time to ask your physician or your provider, what would hospice look like, and would they be willing to make a phone call to us? We take it from there. We work directly with the family and the patient themselves in their journey to meet whatever goals, whatever they're looking, is most important to them at that time. So calling is very simple. Just give us a call at 208-265-1179. You can always call, ask questions of us. We can help you to have that conversation with your family, with your physicians. We're there to support you.
Thank you very much. And we're walking with you all the way.